Google. So big, they deserve two episodes. Last week, we had two of Google's top engineering leaders, Hiram Wright and Titus Winters. And this week, they're back for part two, talking about their fantastic book, Software Engineering at Google, Lessons Learned from Programming Over Time.
This episode is sponsored by Linear B. Give your dev team the power to improve with team-based metrics, high-risk code alerts, and the world's first project board based on real-time Git activity. Sign up free at linearb.io.
Hey everyone, welcome to Dev Interrupted. I'm your host, Dan Lines, and today we are talking to Hiram Wright and Titus Winters. Hiram and Titus, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
This has been a really insightful, interesting, amazing conversation. Are there any other areas within Google that shifting left is working well? And also, is there any areas where you'd say, hey, shifting left is actually a bad thing?
So amusingly, I just hosted an internal workshop discussing the left shifting philosophy just recently. And there were a couple points where we realized, yeah, you can go to something like if you have editor save hooks that go through and delete your unused imports, that might be annoying. I wrote that import. I'm about to go use it. I accidentally hit save and you just deleted the thing. Probably don't do that. That is shifting the fix a little bit too aggressively to the left. But there are a lot of things where we're finding deeper value in having pushed it this way. Like one of my favorites, and it's alluded to, but even my thinking on it was not as advanced at the point that the book was finalized. One of my favorites is a couple pages in the continuous integration chapter, where I'm going to argue that everything that we know about monitoring and alerting in production is directly parallel to unit testing and CI, right? All of the stats, all of the things that you are observing, QPS, disk usage, network, per application statistics, everything that you're using, that you're monitoring in production, right? The same logic and philosophy applies to unit tests. And your CI is exactly the same as your alerting system. And therefore, you can go read all of the SRE knowledge, wisdom, philosophy on monitoring and alerting and apply that to your testing and level up immediately. And that's brilliant. So yeah, there's a lot. We're not done yet by any means.
Great concept there. Totally makes sense. Let's discuss trade-off. Hiram, at a high level, it feels like maybe every decision, even in life, there's some sort of trade-off that maybe needs to be made. How should we think about it in relation to software engineering?
I had a professor in grad school who said engineering is the science of trade-offs. And this was in electrical engineering or some much more physically constrained, if you will, engineering discipline. But you know, it's the science of trade-offs. We have to make decisions about, are we going to put more engineer time on a specific project to try to optimize it and perhaps save computational resources? Are we just going to throw more computational resources at a problem and not worry about our software? What are we going to choose to spend our time on as we are software engineers, so we're doing things? One of the discussions that Titus and I have been involved in a lot internally is around technical debt. And that domain, how do we address technical debt internally? How do we incentivize it? And it actually turns out that a lot of people are really interested in cleaning up technical debt. It also turns out there's a lot of technical debt that you don't need to clean up, that it's an acceptable level of technical debt in kind of the ecosystem. I have a whole other talk you can go find where I talk about like technical debt as pollution in an ecosystem, because there's a much more varied kind of way of thinking about it. But so people say, hey, I cleaned up this thing. I spent my whole week doing this. And we sit back and say, like, that wasn't actually the most important thing for you to do, right? Like you just traded off your time for a thing that wasn't actually that valuable. And so in the software engineering discipline, we need to be thinking about, number one, what are the most impactful things that we can be doing? And then how do we, you know, make those decisions in our organization? And we try to use as much data as we possibly can. If we could make every decision, if we had perfect data, we wouldn't actually need to make the decision because the decision made for us. We have an automatic system that makes the decision. The reason we pay people and humans to do things is because they need judgment and they need insight, and we don't have perfect information. We have to make decisions and underneath those constraints and move forward. But we also need to be willing to revisit those decisions as the constraints change. So as the system evolves, as the data changes, as our ability to do things changes, we need to be able to revisit those decisions. Several years ago, when we first started doing these kind of mass migrations within our code base, like we obviously looked at the most highest priority ones. What are the things that really matter the most? And let's focus on that. And as we got better and better at this, one day Titus came to me and said, there is a file that has a dash in its name. And that really bugs me. I wish it was an underscore because it was like inconsistent with the rest of the files in that directory. And we actually had data on this. We saw that engineers were mistyping the name consistently, and that was causing build failures, and they had to go back and fix their code, right? All these kinds of things. And so he says, I would really like if we could change this hyphen as a word separator into an underscore. And so we did, right? There was, I think, 50,000 references to this file across the entire code base, but our ability to make those kinds of changes had improved to the point where the decision, should we make that change or not, had changed. We'd gotten good enough at it that we could make that change with relatively low overhead and justify it based upon the very real costs that we could show that people were paying because this hyphen was an underscore, or because we had a hyphen instead of an underscore.
We don't want to annoy Titus, so that probably loaded a lot into that decision-making factor.
Less than you'd think.
A lot of our listeners are having to make these decisions and trade-offs like every single day. As a software engineer, you're making decisions. Do either of you have any tips of what questions you might want to ask yourself in determining, should I do this thing around technical debt or not?
I think the most important piece, especially as we get more experienced in our careers, a lot of people come around to the idea that it is much more important to make a decision that you can undo. Like I'm much less concerned with, is this necessarily the right decision, so much as what are the stakes here? If we make this decision and it's wrong, can we undo it? That's very important. I find most of the questions that I ask to the more junior people in my teams are mostly about, I'm just checking your work and like looking at your reasoning. And I'm perfectly willing to trust you to make those decisions, so long as we have the ability to like change our mind if additional information comes up that like shows that, oh, nope, we're wrong. Okay, let's be honest about that. Let's move along. And I think that actually honesty ties a lot into the trade-offs and decision-making equation of it is far too easy for people to get caught up in, I'm going to argue that I'm right and I'm going to base my worth and my career stakes on, yes, I did this thing and I was right. And that's really not engineering. It's really not rational. That's something else. And when we can build a culture around, yep, okay, screwed that up, let's go fix it. Everyone learns, and that accelerates. It's a question of, are you optimizing for yourself in the short term or for the team in the long term? And yeah, that turns out to be real important too.
Yeah, excellent. I'm sure if you're in that mindset that you're in this defensive state, that's going to cloud all of your judgment in decision making. Hiram, any tips from you on maybe some questions you ask yourself internally or to a junior when making a decision? Should I do this thing or not do this thing?
One of the core things, this is tangentially related to your question, but I think we'll come back to it. That came out of writing the book that we didn't expect was a discussion around constraints. Mm-hmm. And the fact that chosen constraints of a system, of an API, right, actually are very powerful. And so the question I ask when we're doing design or when I'm reviewing a change or whatever is, what are the constraints that this imposes? Like, how can this be abused by people? Hiram's law related issues, right? But what are the constraints that we can use to help guide people to the right set of behaviors as they consume the system or as they use this thing? A well-chosen set of constraints turns out to make evolvability much easier in a broader software context. It means you can undo some of those decisions that Titus was just talking about. It means that you're able to guide people in the right thing, being somewhat subjective, but that it's almost better to have folks doing similar things, like consistent in, even if it's not in the perfect thing. And that having appropriate constraints on a system or its evolution are actually really important. So thinking about those constraints, if I'm providing infrastructure, if I'm providing a system to somebody, right, what are the constraints that I would want to put on them? And oftentimes we think of constraints as like limiting. You know, I can't do things, I'm being constrained. But I think there's lots of constraints we interact with on a regular basis, right? Like traffic signals being a very common one. Very few of us think that red lights are somehow limiting to it. I'm grateful that the red light tells me that I shouldn't go into the intersection and get creamed by the guy going across the way. These are important sets of constraints in our lives. And if we think carefully about the kinds of constraints in the systems that we're designing, it can be very powerful in providing a long-term sustainable view of the software.
Yeah, most of the chapters, like we seeded it with everyone should talk about time and scale and trade-offs. Almost every chapter surfaced like, oh, and it turns out it's a really good idea for your organization to constrain this. A fair number of chapters were, and I know that Hiram's Law is a thing, but it's a lot of a thing for our problem. That was also amusing. But the constraints thing is counterintuitive because when you're building a product or a platform or something, and you're like, you're looking for adoption, like you want to support everything, right? And so you try to do everything. And that makes sense. But within the bounds of one organization, the more that you can ratchet things down and lock off the less used pieces, like the more flexibility that you will have for changing decisions in the future without having to deal with the fact that one team picked up this exotic dependency on something that you supported. You know, Hiram's Law applies there too. And yeah, like it's good for within the bounds of an organization in particular to have as few ways to do anything as reasonable.
Yeah, it seems like you'll probably gain a good amount of efficiency, sometimes creativity mm-hmm. with constraints mm-hmm. and focus. And that's usually a good thing for humans interacting with a product. And
yep. Just a quick answer, like just an example, code formatting. Yes. People yes. They view their code format as like a very personal thing. There must be tabs and not spaces, and there must be this many, and the brace goes exactly here, all these kinds of things. Very early on, like we introduced a code formatter. Go had one from the very beginning. We added one for C++ when we started doing a lot of automated changes because we had to format the code to look like a person wrote it. Yeah. And
Clang format is our fault.
Yeah, Clang format's our fault.
We had to have that in order to get our job.
But once you take formatting out of the equation, right? Like people can just write software and the whole part of your brain that worries about where does the variable go? Like where does the line break go? Does the star go on this side or that side of the name? And that whole part of your brain can be reclaimed for like doing actual important stuff and not worrying about that kind of thing. Because you've constrained the format of the code. And now I just run a tool and it just does the right thing for me. And I just don't have to worry about it all. Like, turns out that personally, I don't care about any of this stuff. I just want it to be consistent and I want it to work. And those constraints are really powerful in that kind of context.
Yeah, let's use our brain power on tough problems, not where mm-hmm. the semicolon goes. So incredibly, those three pillars that we just covered, time, scale, and trade-off, they might come out throughout the entire book, but focus on the first chapter. It looks like the rest of the book is about culture. You have policies, you have tools. We only have time to dive into one more of those topics. And so let's hit on culture a little bit. So I think any seasoned engineering leader knows the extreme importance of culture. So I'd really like to hear from each of you on this topic. Why is culture so important, and what is something you've learned about it during your time at Google? Titus, let's start with you on this one.
Sure. So there's a culture talk that I've started giving in the last few months that sort of starts out with the idea of think back to how most of us learned, right? Like most of us learned in university or in a boot camp or something. And you're in lecture and you get some slides. You have some assignments and you're told we have to see if you know the material. So don't cheat. Don't talk with anyone else about it. So you're going to go off and do your assignment by yourself. The only time that a human looks at your assignment is some anonymous grader that is literally judging. And you iterate on this for a few years and then you get a degree and you go off into industry. And it is entirely reasonable, at least in Western universities at this point, for a graduate of a CS program to have not actually ever witnessed a programmer program. Like we have this whole idea of you're just going to be up late at night alone in a dark, and the only time that you ever actually see someone else program code must be shameful, right? That is the lesson that we have transmitted to basically every tech grad for the last 20 or 30 years. And then we move them into, oh, congratulations, now you're in software engineering. Now we need you to be thinking not only about the production of that, but how the team is going to maintain it over time. And that is an entirely different thing. right? We need almost immediately a 180 shift from you're going to iterate on this thing in private by yourself forever until it's perfect to what we actually want Nooglers to do. 2 hours into a thing, show us your work in progress so that we can get a sense of it and nudge you in the right direction so you don't go learn a bunch of bad habits or waste a bunch of time, right? And the more that we can be collaborative, the better. But that's really hard because that also means that you have to be willing to ask questions, be willing to admit that you don't know things. And if you find yourself on a team where people are like, how can you not know this? Then you're disincentivized for, you know, asking questions. And this cycle is deadly. And as I've been saying, you know, loudly and to everyone that'll listen for quite a while now, it's at least as important to be a good person as it is to be a great programmer if you want to succeed in tech. Because as it turns out, just building a team that actually has your back, that is supportive, that where you're okay admitting mistakes, so that the team can learn from those mistakes, that team over 6 months is absolutely going to win over a similar size team of superstar jerks. I'll put money on it. And that is not the message that we give because we don't talk about it. And turns out, I think software engineering is largely a communication and cultural problem on top of, oh, and you have to be like, it's also important to be a good programmer. But like, if I'm hiring, I'm going to try to get a sense of, are you a good person? Because I can make you a great programmer. That I know. I don't know how to necessarily make you a better person. So I'm going to do the one that I'm going to get a shop around for the one that I don't know how to fix.
Excellent. Yeah, absolutely. And it's a little bit of a shame and can be a big, I guess, culture shock if you're used to being more egocentric. I'm coding on my own. This is my code. I'm afraid to ask a question.
Yeah.
Now I'm getting put into an environment where it's like a collaborative team sport. I don't know what I'm doing here. So I assume some people maybe don't make that transition and probably not going to last at Google too long. And other people hopefully are able to adapt and start kicking ass with the team.
That's the hope. But and we're not as good at telling people that that is the nature of the job as we really should be, because we're figuring this out as we go too.
Yeah, I was certainly never told that in college. I had no idea. Hiram, same question to you. Why is culture so important, and what is something you've learned about it during your time at Google?
So there's a saying, culture eats strategy for breakfast or something like that. When I was did a bunch of work with the Apache Software Foundation, and they were saying like community over code, right? Like these both kind of encapsulate this notion that without the right culture, it actually doesn't matter a whole lot. Like you can write good, you can get some software, you can build a product, you can write a thing. But there's a hard upper bound on the complexity of the system you can build if you haven't got the cultural things figured out. I don't think there's like a one true culture. Google certainly has a culture and other companies have cultures, right? There's not a one true culture that you have to have, but I think the successful ones share common characteristics of willingness to be open about concerns, willingness to be humble about things. There's a lot of willingness to make mistakes, willingness to share mistakes. So just yesterday, I had a concern about something a director said in a meeting, and I emailed them and was like, hey, just so you know, this could maybe be taken out of context in the wrong way. And like, this person emailed me back, because hey, I really appreciate that feedback, and I'll try to remember that, and done these kinds of things, right? And I was really grateful that I felt a little bit out of my league making this observation, but I was really grateful that the response was very welcoming. And it even said something to the effect that we don't agree on everything. And as I thought about that, I'm like, no one agrees on everything, right? Like it's impossible for everyone to agree on everything. And Titus and I don't agree on everything. That's okay. But
yes,
being willing to, wait a second, being willing to admit that and to internalize it and to accept that as like part of the process is really important. So the more I've learned as I've been doing software engineering for however many years, right, is that this is actually not a technical problem. Software engineering is not a technical problem. And we all love the technology. We love to argue about everything from what's the latest web framework to how many iCache misses am I going to have if I use this instruction instead of that instruction. We love to have those discussions. But the fundamental problems in software engineering, like is in almost every discipline known to mankind, personkind, is the people problem. right? The interactions between people, the communication, the how do you help people? How do you encourage people? How do you get them to do the best thing they want to do? I want people to be great and to do the best they can, not because they love Google or they love me or whatever, but because it makes them happy and they want to do their thing. And if I can help them do that as a leader in my organization and whatever else, right, then that will produce better software in the long term. It may take more effort in the short term, but it will produce much better results and solve better problems more efficiently in the longest, the time horizons that we're looking at. And that's why I think culture is such an important part of building a successful organization.
Very well said. Hiram and Titus, thank you so much for coming on the pod today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Make sure to check out Hiram and Titus's new book, Software Engineering at Google, Lessons Learned from Programming Over Time. The book is available free of charge, and we'll have a link in the description.
Also, be sure to join the Dev Interrupted Discord community, where we keep this type of conversation going all week long. You can find information about everything we talked about in the links below, and everyone, have a great weekend.